Hello, my name is David Lankus. I'm a professor at Syracuse University's School of Information Studies, the iSchool, and we've been playing around with MOOCs. We offered a MOOC last spring on data scientists. We had about 4,000 people go through that. And then in the summer, we offered the first MOOC out of a library and information science program on new librarianship that I helped put together and helped teach. So I've been asked very graciously to come and talk a little bit about, as a case study, what happened? What was the MOOC like? How did it participate? And then think a little bit further about what the implications of that MOOC experience are for libraries in general. So I'm going to really try and look at MOOCs in terms of public libraries and academic libraries and special libraries and school libraries, but across the board. And I'll try to say if one fits another better. But I'm going to just begin with a little bit of why we did this. So when we look at the motivation, why did the iSchool do MOOCs, particularly this MOOC? Well, the first is to provide professional development. As you'll see later in our implications, I see and the school sees the idea of the continuous preparation of librarians is very important. The notion that you learned everything you ever needed to know in library school, I don't think that's holding up too well. And so we wanted to talk about how we could continue to engage the profession, continue to enrich the profession, and really, frankly, continue to learn from the profession about how it's going. The second is to increase the reputation of the iSchool and SU. That's interesting because that was our intention, and there was a little worry about that would happen. You know, when you offer a MOOC, you don't quite know how many people are going to sign up and who's going to be there, and, you know, is the technology going to work? This is still a play game. And while we're playing out loud, and we're playing in public. And so on one hand, yes, we want to give out good content and a good experience to be first in the market and really show how great we are to build our reputation. On the other hand, if we screwed it up, it was really going to damage our reputation. So something to think about, which is when you're playing out loud, how much do people know that you're playing? How much do you make that evident to them? How much do they understand that they're guinea pigs and we're guinea pigs and we're all in this together? And how much of this is look at how great we are and bang our chests and all that wonderful stuff? We wanted to experiment in the MOOC space. Let's face it, right now in higher education, where I sit in the United States, MOOCs are the word. Now, we can talk about sort of the hype cycle about where it sits, and, you know, is it still the greatest thing ever? Is it going to be the silver bullet? But a lot of universities are trying it, and let's be honest, a lot of high-name, high-visibility universities from Harvard and MIT and such are trying this, and so Syracuse wants to play that game, too. And we wanted to experiment in the MOOC space, but we didn't necessarily want to do it by joining edX or Coursera or some of these already existing consortia. We wanted to see what our role is and how we could learn from it. And last, we wanted, particularly with this MOOC, the new librarianship MOOC, we wanted to experiment with business models. One of the things that I'm going to talk about and you're going to see is that the notion of what is the business model behind the MOOC is still a wide open question. This idea of where do we fit and how do we make money on this and do we make money on this or is this always going to be a gift? And if we do make money on it, what do we price it and will that undercut our tuition? And you get the point. The one we wanted to look at for our data sciences MOOC that we offered in the spring was sort of the lost leader idea, that we offered this course on data sciences, and look, we happen to have a certificate of advanced studies, a graduate degree sort of before the master's degree, in data sciences. And if you take this MOOC, you can sort of skip a course or get some credit towards that degree. And so we wanted to do the same thing about providing professional development and reputation and explore the space. The business experiment, which frankly is at the bottom of that, but the business experiment in that case was, can we move people more into our traditional business model? The business case for this MOOC that I'm going to talk about, the new librarianship MOOC, is there a market or money for continuing education? In the United States, a lot of librarians have to go for recertification as a public librarian or recertification as a school librarian, and they need to take courses, and they're willing to pay. Oftentimes, their institutions are willing to pay for that. Is there a market? Can we grab some of that market? And we talk a little bit about how that turned out. So that gives you a sense of why we did it, right? Personal motivation here as well, right? So this is based on new librarianship, and frankly, a lot of that is based on books that I wrote, which we'll talk about in a second. So there's a personal reputation side of this as well, that not only did we want to get out there to talk about how the school could build reputation, but I wanted to further a personal research agenda, which meant that it was worth my time to develop. One question that I'm not really going to address too much is, what is the cost of development of these courses? And I developed this sort of on my own time, think of it as part of my research agenda. So it was valuable to me, but the school didn't necessarily have to pay for that. That wasn't the case in the previous. But there was a motivation on my part, once again, around developing experimentation, professional development, the business model, as well as that closely aligning with the institution that we're part of. So let's go into who signed up. So when we first announced it, we said, hey, who wants to take this? And we put up a web form and allowed people to fill it in. So this was approximately a month or two before the course sort of launched. So we wanted a way to capture people's interest before the course was ready to be opened up. And so we created this web form, and we got about 3,100 people to sign up saying, yes, we're interested. A month later, when we actually had the course and we opened up and were ready, people had to then go in and create an account on a site called CourseSites. CourseSites is a public MOOC environment put together by the Blackboard folks. It uses their Blackboard technology, but they're making it available sort of open and free to people to try out and create these MOOCs. But the point is that they had to fill out a web form, and then they had to do a separate enrollment process where they had to create an account. And as you can see, the number of people who actually enrolled was about 2,400. So we lost a fair amount of people between those who said, sounds great, let me know how it's going, and those who actually said, let me jump in. So you'll get a sense then of some of the demographic information. That's what the chart's providing. The majority of people signed up were between 25 and 34, and you can see that really it's a not too skewed young demographic, but we had ample across that age range. Makes sense that not too many 15-year-olds signed up for the MOOC, but hey, you never know. You get a sense of where they signed up. This was clearly a North American experiment. I mean, these were where, you know, we sort of operate and talk and where our social media sort of goes out. We had plenty of people. I know we had some in the UK who joined us. And then you can see that the demographics of male and female is sort of representative of the librarian profession. And you can see that mostly full-time and part-time people signed up as well. So they asked them, why did you sign up? And the primary thing they told us was, we wanted professional development. So we just wanted to learn. And in fact, when we get back to our completion rates, which is the next slide, you'll see that the completion rate wasn't 100%. And it wasn't necessarily the 10% that you see in MOOCs. We'll talk about that in a minute. But we had lots of people who signed up and expressly said, I'm not here to get the CEU. I'm not going to take the quizzes or necessarily, but I want to watch the videos. I want to just read the discussion. So they were there for professional or personal development. A few people talked about formal study. There were a lot of people in there just curious about what a MOOC is and what it looks like, including, frankly, the instructor on that one. So how many people that signed up finished? Well, that's a little bit more of a complex question than you might think. 281 of the 2,400 people signed up got the certificate of completion. That means that they did all the quizzes, filled out a bunch of evaluation forms, and they got this sort of electronic piece of paper. You stick with me for a minute. So that's a pretty good sample. It's a little bit over the 10% that most people talk about in MOOCs, but it's in the right range. To give you a little bit more complex, 39 people, additional people, did everything but one quiz. In fact, we reached out to them, and we're having some of them complete now. 12 people had everything but two, 10 had everything but three. 1,446 took at least one quiz. So it was a pretty wide participation. We had one person take it for graduate credit, and we had about 20 that signed up for what we call continuing education units. Once again, I apologize if that is not a sort of universal concept, so let me give you a second. We had one person who was taking who's getting their degree at another university, Kent State, and they saw this, and we had an option that said, if you want to sign up for graduate credit, you take the MOOC, and then there's some additional work you have to do on top of it. It was the research papers, more or less, and some discussions and reflections. We had one person do it. Now, why one out of 2,400? Because they had to pay full Syracuse tuition, which is approximately $3,000. So it wasn't a cheap option if you wanted to do it. It doesn't really surprise me that only one person signed up for it. The CEUs are a formal document process. We keep records on them. They're used in public school systems. They're used at the state level for licensure. It costs approximately $150 to get two CEUs. So once again, it doesn't surprise me. One of the things that I think everyone's learning about MOOCs, which is the higher the bar of involvement, meaning money, time, what have you, the fewer the completion rates. And so we had 20 people who sort of spent the money. And you'll see, by the way, when I mention those numbers, why we're sort of dealing with this business model. We'll come back to that in a second, which is, are we really going to replace $3,000 a course with $150 a course and still be able to stay in business? I don't think so. Anyway, let's see what they thought about it once they were in. So the question was, overall, this MOOC has been a positive learning experience for me. Agree, disagree. So we had approximately 153 people strongly agree, 128 agree with us. So we think that, you know, getting up to 90% of people liking it, that's a good sign. We had 5 people who clearly did not enjoy their time here. These are what we normally get. Actually, that's a pretty high thing if you compare it to a traditional graduate course. Next slide, we're going to talk about how would you describe your actual level of participation during the MOOC. So this is when we asked at the end, tell us how much you were sort of part of the class and participating. 43 said they were memorably active. In other words, they were posting and they were really involved. Another 157 said they would moderately contribute. They posted a few posts, et cetera, did a lot of reading. 4 people said they registered but never really got going. 95 said that they were in there and watching, but they didn't necessarily post or participate. And 9 started but never ended. I should give you a quick sense. Let me just finish this slide up. Total time for those 2,400 people, they took 10,335 hours of time doing this. And I should tell you about the structure in a second. Average time per user was about 4.5 hours, and that ranges anywhere from someone who had 0 hours, they didn't really actually log on, to someone who actually was logged in 93 hours over a month to do this. Now, technically wise, that means their computer was logged in. Whether they were actually sort of watching the computer is another question, but that gives you the range. I should give you a sense of when they talk about participation in what. So let me back up 1 second and talk about what this course actually looked like. The course was a month-long course, so it was 4 weeks. We divided them into weeks. I can talk a little bit about why we did that in a second. Each week covered a different area. So they covered out of talking about librarianship and new librarianship, and the curriculum was based closely around something called the Atlas of New Librarianship. We'll talk about that in a second. And so week 1, they would learn about things like worldview and mission. 2nd is, what is knowledge and how does knowledge work? And then they would learn about facilitation. In the 2nd week, they would learn about what do we mean by the improved society and the obligation to improve society, how do we interact with communities and librarians. In the 3rd week, we moved on to looking at libraries as institutions, and in the 4th week, we looked at sort of communities and how we view and represent communities. So it was a 4-week timeline. Each week had a series of lectures. Those lectures went anywhere from 20 minutes to 10 minutes, and there were maybe 4 or 5 of them. Per week, per unit. And then they had readings on top of that that were recommended and assigned. And it was a relatively traditional. Watch the lecture, do the reading, and then we had discussion groups around each topic that people could participate in. We have some stats talking about that in a second. It wasn't a crazy sort of trying different ways. There's some MOOCs going on now that are called connectivist MOOCs. One in the library area called the Hyper MOOC, based on Michael Stevens' Hyperlinked Library, which is very much a connectivist MOOC where you have lots of people making blog posts and connecting and talking to each other. The goal of this course was awareness. We wanted people to be aware of new librarianship, to provoke some thoughts and ideas, but it wasn't necessarily mastery, and it wasn't necessarily turning that mastery into some sort of construction project, what have you. It was built to be high touch in the sense that instructors were going to be there, answer questions, be visible, but it wasn't going to be so high touch that it was things like doing essays and much more authentic assessments, doing sort of lots of critique back and forth. The idea was that we wanted to find the sort of sweet spot, which the stats are showing were close, that would show that there was a participation in the discussion, but not necessarily the same workload that we would expect for application or in a graduate course, and graduate course of 25 people. We really were looking for something that would work for 2,500 people. So anyway, that gives you a sense of how active they were. The next slide shows you what they thought they were going to do versus what they did. So in the pre-evaluation, most people thought they would be a moderate contributor, and turns out most people were a moderate contributor. So next level was active contributor. Turns out a fewer people were active and memorable. So you can see there was a pretty good estimation of people who thought that what they thought they would do and what they actually did. Another sort of indication of how much involvement there was in the course, discussion posts. So there wasn't an obligation to post to forums and have conversations, but they could. And one of the big criticisms of this platform was that it was hard to sort of join it in midstream. People would sort of, they joined the course was open, they joined Wednesday instead of Monday, and already there were 300 messages they had to read through. We have yet to find a technology that can really support 2,500 people talking at once. So, but they did pretty well, but what happens is people start out really gung-ho and then participation drops. And you can see that here. Week one, 447 posts, right? And then week two, about half of that, and week three, half of the half, and then week four, it sort of begins to level out. But it was a pretty active conversation. The other thing that we'll talk about in a minute is for those people who really didn't like the discussion boards, this leaked out into people doing blog posts and the discussion threads on blog posts. A lot of Twitter activity was going on where people were tweeting about this. Also, many people formed their own groups. The Montana librarians created a Facebook group just so they could do it. There was a group who did a shared Evernote notebook amongst themselves. So there was lots of people who may not have been discussing it in this platform, but where discussion was occurring elsewhere. So then we asked, based on your experience with the MOOC, how likely would you do another one with us at Syracuse? And we got everything from 33% saying completely likely, and additional 37% saying very likely, moderately likely, and apparently 1% that we have now completely turned off on Syracuse, and we're sorry, and we apologize to our chancellor. But anyway, you can see that, once again, this is pretty good for what we're thinking about. Raising that as a larger question, probably much more relevant to the folks in the room there. Based on your experience with this MOOC, how would you do any MOOC at any institution? And once again, we're going from completely likely and very likely. Not a massive change, but apparently we only turned one person off to the whole concept of MOOC. So hopefully that's not too much damage. I mentioned before that what we used was course sites, this Blackboard online site that people can register and log into and utilize. It covers things like mounting the video and having the discussion groups and quizzes and evaluations tools, that kind of thing. And so we asked, what'd you think of course sites? And I'll be honest, I was kind of surprised that there's a pretty high satisfaction rating with that. Partly because a lot of people were experimenting with MOOCs and didn't know any different or any better or have to compare with, and partly because it did, frankly, a good job. One of the things that we learned from course sites is that we prototyped this. So we put all the content online, and the original idea was to just put it all out there and let people sort of pick and choose and go through it as they will. And I was working on a project at the State of Illinois and the Institute for Museum and Library Services here in the States. And so we sort of did that. We said, here it is. Same lectures, same quizzes, same content, same readings, same slides. Go for it. See what you think. And we had zero participation. In fact, we got feedback going, when is it going to start? When is it going to start? And the answer was, it started. It started. So the one major change that we made between that pretest and when we actually launched and where you're seeing the stats is we moved from just an open, here's all the content, here are all the discussions, to a week-by-week format. Here's week one, and here are the expected outcomes. Here's what you should do first, second, third. We were much more prescriptive in how you move through the MOOC and made lots more sort of signposts about moving from system to system, step by step. And that made all the difference in participation. So one of the things you may want to think about if you're designing a MOOC is to think about the idea of not just the content, but how do we guide people through that content? How do we give them lots of signposts throughout? So once again, people were satisfied with the MOOC. Now, I mentioned before that the majority of the content was based on a book that I had done called The Atlas of New Librarianship, and all the required readings came out of the Atlas, and so it makes sense to ask them what they thought of the readings, really, what they think of my book, right? So this is a personal question. Once again, apparently three people will never read me again, and that's sort of to be expected, but on the whole, it did well. One question, if we have any authors in the room you may want to know, is how did this affect sales? And this chart shows you how many of my books sold on Amazon. Now, that's a nice spike, you can see. But that's not completely representative because the other thing we did was we had a partnership with MIT Press, the publisher of the book, and they provided a 20% discount on the book if you went directly through MIT Press. So while this shows a spike, they also had a nice spike of people who went directly for them. One of the complaints that people are talking about MOOCs is that rather than looking at them as classrooms and innovating learning, they really feel like augmented textbooks. I think that's a criticism that's fair of this course, I'll be honest. But then again, it's kind of a new, interesting idea. I've said that, you know, rather than writing another book, my next book might well be a MOOC. This idea that you can put up the text and have people directly commenting, discussing, talking around it, is a really interesting idea. We'll come back to that in a second. As I mentioned, the format of this was a series of videos plus readings discussions. What'd you think of the videos? Really worked to keep the videos as short as possible. Rather than 3-hour long lectures, we really tried to keep them at 5, 10, 30 minutes was max. I think, like I say, somewhere around 20 was our longest. Once again, I think the videos went really well. I know that there was more watching the video than reading of the books. And the other thing that we did here, which I think is indicative of sort of the ethos we put behind it, but also serves those functions of PR and, you know, getting the word out, was we made all the videos available through a Creative Commons license on Vimeo. We made all the slides available under a Creative Commons license on Vimeo. In other words, here are these videos, here are these slides, free to use, however, wherever you want. We put them on YouTube as well so people could embed them in blog posts, could embed them in other course management systems. We've actually taken the videos here at Syracuse, and we use them to flip the classroom in our introductory course. So that people are watching, so our students, our first year master's students are watching these lectures on their own time, and when they come into class, we're having structured discussions and activities rather than just me talking at them. So we're looking at the idea of these videos, how they can have utility beyond just the MOOC. I mentioned before that when you're looking at 400 posts at the end of the first week, a lot of people said, not me. And what happened was that a lot of this conversation went beyond what was happening in that discussion board. So this just gives you a sense of some of the blog postings that went on about the site, that people were in learning and they were then saying, ooh, here's an idea, here's what I think about it. Some were doing a traditional sort of, here's what I thought of week one, here's what I thought of week two. Some of them had very specific ideas they wanted to talk about. For example, there was a discussion about the role of narrative fiction and sort of storytelling in new librarianship, because new librarianship is very much about sort of knowledge and learning. And while there's this line that says you learn from fiction as well, it's not very well developed. Someone took that idea and did a beautiful blog posting talking about the need for multiple narratives and interacting with multiple stories and cultures and such, and it was a beautiful post. And that happened outside of the site, and then lots of Twitter to tie it all together. So we had an active discussion around the new lib hashtag. I mentioned Facebook groups and a Google group shared Evernote. So what happened, which I love, is while the course felt very sort of hierarchical and traditional, the connectivist part, which is near and dear to my heart, occurred by people taking that content, taking that discussion, taking that anchor point, and then branching out and connecting in their own worlds and their own communities and their own discussion. So it was connectivist, thank goodness, in the end, because it sort of generated a larger conversation about the field. So I was very happy. In case you're wondering what it takes to put one of these on, this was the team. So the faculty, there was me who did the videos and sort of the main authoring, and then we had three other faculty members on the iSchool faculty who participated in the discussion, who made sure the discussion was lively, provided alternative perspectives, things of that nature. We had an instructional designer. That instructional designer helped me move from the here's everything, work your way through it, to here's 1 week, 2 weeks, we need the objectives, as well as helping me with the tools. We had technical support, so as people had problems with the discussion groups, as people had, where do I do this, how do I add this link, et cetera, they were on hand to help with that. The program director, the person who sort of helps administratively guide our library science program, had to be involved. They helped with things like the continuing education units, as well as the academic credit, as well as dealing with things like, all right, if someone takes this MOOC, can they also then take that class that we're using these videos for? How do we administratively handle it? Things of that nature. Making sure that the policies and systems were checked off. And we had a strong participation from our promotional people where we were putting it out, saying, here, come join us, be part of it, as well as communicating with people who expressed interest to say, it's time to register, week one's finished, have you looked at this, etc. So the big question, what did we learn from doing it? Well, the first is that we discovered, to our great relief, that there's a desire for deep conversation on librarianship, that the content was interesting and the content was engaged. New librarianship and the approach of this MOOC is very much about the fundamentals of the why of our profession. It talks about the theory of learning and us being learning organizations. So it's abstract. It deals with some specific instances, you know, here's an example. But it's not a technical course. For example, Jeffrey Pomerantz is offering a course on metadata through Coursera and University of North Carolina. And his is very much how do you do this and try this and link this, which is very important. But ours was very much a much more ethereal conversation about what is the nature of librarianship. We had conversations about what is the nature of reality, about conversation theory, about epistemology. We had discussions about ethics. We had discussions about what does it mean to be biased and unbiased and worldview. And there was a really brilliant, wonderful conversation both within the MOOC and through these Twitter feeds and blog posts and such that really showed there's a strong desire to talk about our profession beyond simply the how do we do stuff. The other thing we learned about, and I'm going to break these out in some detail, is that, and this is a very sort of academic learning exercise, but it's the idea that we need to shift thinking about how higher ed works, right? So one of the questions is, will MOOCs destroy higher education as we know it? And the answer is, I don't think so, because one, there's no business model there. And the other is, it only looks at one aspect of higher education, which is the teaching part, which is important. But what about the research part? What about the idea of socialization? Where do we deal with these other things? But what we really looked at is, how would this change higher education? What do we learn from this? And so what we've realized is that right now, most of what we do is based on commencement, is based on the idea that we give you a degree at the beginning of your career. Okay, you want to be an engineer? Here's your bachelor's degree. Okay, you want to be a writer? You want to be a chemist? You want to be whatever? Here's your bachelor's degree. 4 years, you've learned it, go away, you're off to the field. And then at some point, as you're in the field and either your knowledge becomes increasingly out of date or you move up to administration or you gain this sense that there's another skill, like I love reading but now I really am curious about librarianship, what have you, we'll bring you back and in two and a half years, we'll give you a master's degree. So we'll recharge you to restart your career or move up in your career. And when eventually that begins to wear out or you begin to ask why questions or you need to move up into higher administration, no problem, come back and you give us a big check and we'll give you a doctorate. Right? So this is what we can call the commencement model. Right? The higher education is a sporadic intersection with a student's life at the beginning of a career path, and then we shift them into alums where we ask them for lots of money. The question around our MOOC in thinking was, can we move to a continuing education model? In other words, can we supplement those initial commencements with now giving them periodic interactions and more education as we go? Can we sort of give them booster shots along the way? Yeah, there's an economic issue with that, but there's really a much more interesting potential here, which is around this concept of continuous education. Now, in continuous education, you know, we're still going to deal with someone at the beginning of their career, and we want to then build a relationship with that student, we'll talk about that in a second, over their entire lifespan. So we want to move them from just starting their career to becoming very advanced in their career and eventually retiring from their career. And we know that they're going to interact both at sort of their work life and there's this education level, but it needs to be continuous. This idea that somehow you can learn to be a librarian in 2.5 years at the beginning of your career and you'll never need more refreshers on the latest technology, the latest management style. Ooh, I think I took budgeting somewhere in that course 10 years ago, but I can't remember it. This idea that you need to constantly and continuously refresh your knowledge is important. And it's this higher education, instead of looking at this commencement model, which is this periodic intersection, looks at it instead as a sort of continuous flow and interaction back and forth. That what happens is you get your bachelor's degree and you go off and as you're going through your career and you discover something new, you can touch back in with your higher education institution. Instead of becoming an alumni, you become like a member. Instead of paying one flat tuition per degree, maybe it's a subscription model. And the idea is that you're constantly flowing back and forth into that learning process. And what's more is that rather than just being a student throughout that process, there are going to be times when you're going to be teaching your old academy what you know. So you go out, you get this job, you learn about, develop, create this new thing. You can be teaching it to other people who have this relationship. And over time, you become both instructor as well as student, and you're constantly moving back and forth. And that what happens is you're constantly learning not only from one institution, but you're saying, I took this webinar, and I'm at this conference, and where does that fit in? That maybe with that connection is you're going back to your institution instead of to get the instruction, to accredit the instruction. In other words, I did all this wonderful stuff. Give me credit for it because I now know how to XYZ. Your institution, Syracuse University, whatever, can sort of bless it and say, yes, you do. That's part of your sort of personal education record that will carry through. So next time you apply for a job and you want to give them the resume, you can also give them a link that says, and here's my personal education record. So every skill in there has been certified by Syracuse University, Harvard, whatever, that I know that. Even though I didn't necessarily take all the courses from them, didn't pay that big tuition, I have this ongoing relationship where as I move through, I can constantly pull upon that reputation. And I'm constantly contributing back to that reputation as well. As I'm more successful, that accrediting body becomes more useful. Anyway, that's a much larger discussion. The last lesson learned, and this is really the idea of regardless of library type, is that there is a great opportunity for MOOCs in libraries. First of all, it's almost like we've rediscovered online education. We've been giving master's degrees online for about 20 years now. But the idea that somehow MOOCs have discovered this, what you're really seeing is Ivy League and large universities that for the first time are encountering online education, thinking they've discovered it and being terribly challenged by it. Meanwhile, the rest of the world has moved on. We can Skype and webcast and do this all the time. But that's a great opportunity. First of all, it's a great opportunity, for example, creating a truly public school. If you're in a public library or you're in a school library, you can be hosting and providing the infrastructure for these MOOCs. You can be providing the access point so that people can come and use your infrastructure, get to these MOOCs and information and online education. And so you have the ability to truly become a platform to present as well as consume this information. And so your members, your patrons, can use your library and see it as a vital part of their continuous education process. I love it. The other one is this notion of a publisher of community. That is that rather than just going to the library to take a MOOC, to participate in a MOOC, really you're able to then identify your own expertise and provide a MOOC around it. Do you have someone in the community who's a great historian? Do you have someone in the community who's a great knitter? Do you have someone in the community who's a great programmer? Do you have someone in the community who's fantastic at whatever skill? You can provide them a platform to teach others in a MOOC, in an online education forum, in the ability to go out and reach out. And so the idea that I'm thinking about is, once again, in an academic context, that the new academic press that are closing all around our ears is really the idea of a courseware development system. That not only do you publish the book, but you publish the educational activity and the conversation forum on top of it. Here's the first draft. Here's 100 of our favorite members. They're going to come in, critique, whatever. And then we're going to take the second draft based on that, and that's what we're going to publish out. And not only in an academic sector, but you can imagine this in, once again, a public sector or a business sector, where what you're doing is you're refining your connections back to your members, your patrons, your customers, your consumers, what have you. And that the library becomes the mechanism to do that because not only do they have the infrastructure to do it, not only do they understand the systems to do it, they understand the instructional side, the organizational side, and how to preserve that over time so that we can learn and rebuild and reuse content. In essence, MOOCs give an opportunity, once again, to re-engage our members in a conversation about the importance and utility of libraries. That rather than just being seen as the book people or the archive people or the stuff or the place, we're the function. We're the vital function of our communities, be that community a university, be that community a town, be that community a business, what have you. That we are the vital function of the community, the platform that allows learning to occur, that facilitates learning of the community, by the community, for the community, that takes the expertise of the community and projects it out to the world, increasing reputation and opportunity. That's the value of MOOCs. The infrastructure is out there. The software is out there. The learning is occurring. If libraries can step up and take that hype for a minute and understand that really underlying what they're doing is online learning, which is fundamental to what they're doing, it gives libraries a great chance to promote and accelerate their impact. Thank you very much for your time. I'll accept email questions, whatever. Sorry I couldn't be there in person. Thank you very much.